Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Don't be ridiculous.
Welcome, friends, to Perfect Stranger Things, a weekly dance of joy for your eardrums. This week, Steve and I cover the first hour of the season finale, Piggyback. We will absolutely return to cover the final hour and 20 minutes, so look for that podcast later this week on the same feed. A quick housekeeping note, Steve and I will be covering House of the Dragon. We've already dropped our first preview pod. Look for Double Dragon wherever you search for podcasts. All right, before we jump into the Piggyback, here's a truism from C.C. Tarpley. That's right. It's Mr. Wilford Brimley.
You got a story in here. This is the damnedest story you ever read. Tell you what we're going to do. We're going to sit right here and talk about it. Now, we'll talk all day if you want it.
It's the right thing to do.
Steve, we're just covering the first hour of episode 9, The Piggyback, or as I like to call it, The Piggy Front. And I think we should jump in to our storylines.
Okay.
I've identified 5 storylines, which now means, with Jennifer rules, that we have 2 moons and a Gucher. So I've got an 8-sided die.
All right.
And I'm rolling it. 3 is Dustin and Eddie, part 1. Dustin and Eddie bat-proof the upside-down mobile home, then Eddie plugs in his axe for the most metal concert in the history of the world, and Eddie dedicates his guitar solo to Chrissy. Metallica, it seems, is like catnip for baby Nazguls. Then the boys lock themselves inside. I thought maybe I could just let you talk a little bit about Master of Puppets. This feels like your territory.
Well, this was great. I've got a lot of history with this. It's my first, heavy metal cassette that I ever had. I remember asking my mom to buy it. I think I was 7th or 8th grade, and she wasn't real sure, right? I mean, just because, what is Metallica? Metal's right in the name.
I always was a little bit confused about what is metal, what is heavy metal, what's death metal. None of it really, I was never a metal guy. So yeah. I knew that at some point you just became possessed by Satan. I didn't know where to stop.
Yeah, that's really what it. Yeah, so it's not so much that, like you mentioned, that the song was catnip for these bats. It's just that it's what summons it. It's like if you want to summon something from the upside down, it's got to be heavy metal, right?
Sure.
It's inevitable. So the tape, I remember my mom handing it to me a little bit. Unsure, like she gave me sort of a look.
Which was kind of like that look that she gave you from her perspective. It was like, hey, use with caution, because I'm not sure this is a good idea. But for you, it was like, that's exactly the kind of look that I want.
The reluctant gift from your parent is probably the greatest gift you'll get.
It's the best gift ever.
Yeah, I mean, this is the Red Ryder BB gun moment for me. Yeah. You're going to shoot your salvation out.
All right. So, go ahead.
So I get this. I wore this tape out. I mean, really, there are definitely Metallica albums that I did not purchase. Most of those are later, the Saint Anger kind of phase. So I was, you know, but I certainly was wearing out like all of the, you know, like Ride the Lightnings and the Justice for Alls and all of that good stuff. But Master of Puppets, I think, still, you know, not just because of, you know, that was my first Metallica album, but cassette tape, but it really, I mean, it's so chock full of just bangers. I mean, they're so good. And Master of Puppets is such a great representation of metal, especially during that time frame. You know, you're talking about the different types of metal, right? Like, I'm sure people are going to come and go, this guy doesn't know metal. And, I'm probably a poser. I'll accept that. But the, because there was like, heavy metal, and then there's like speed metal and thrash metal, you know, death metal. Mm-hmm. And at the time, this would have been, I don't know if it would have been truly considered, you know, speed metal. But it was pretty close, because the genre hadn't fully, you know, developed and branched out, I think, at the point of this album. So this album was pretty representative of like pretty heavy stuff. And, but musically, it's really great, and it's just it's a lot of fun. And so I was a little, unsure what to think of the guitar moment in, Stranger Things, because I know it was teased. In previews.
Well, that's what I think I mentioned this before. I think
you thought it was Billy, right?
I thought it was Billy, and I was really nervous about this because it really looked pretty lame.
Yeah, I knew it wasn't Billy. I knew it wasn't Billy, even though I couldn't quite tell it was Eddie, just because I knew of the...
I was worried. I was like, they're going to bring Billy back, and for some reason he's playing electric guitar in the Upside Down, like... This could go really wrong.
Well, and that would have, right? I mean, that would have been a weird thing to do for Billy's character.
Right. And then, I'll be honest, like, the way that they did bring Billy back was fantastic. The way that this whole thing went down was one of my favorite moments of the season. And it happened with Eddie, who I was really uncertain about. I'm probably short selling it. I didn't like Eddie.
Yeah, yeah.
And so for them to pull that off in this episode, it completely changed my mind. I was like, anything, any worry that I had that they couldn't pull this off, I was foolish. I was a fool, Steve. They absolutely, this was the most metal concert in the history of the world.
Yeah, it was so great. I mean, it was such a, it's such an iconic song, especially in that time frame. It would be very true to that character to, you know, if he was going to learn a song, Master of Puppets would be it.
Yeah.
Right. You know, he's Eddie. There's obviously the ref, you know, there's that Iron Maiden overlap and with the mascot that we talked about. So he could have played an Iron Maiden hit, but I like that it went this way. It's just because it's also just a really, it's now, especially at the time, not so much, but now it's because Metallica sort of kind of come into the sort of part of our culture where they're rock, right? I mean, they're still metal, but they're as much a rock band.
Yeah, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That's...
Right. So there is a familiarity with it. And it does harken back to where it's like, hey, yeah, these guys are around right now, but this is where, you know, this is early work of theirs that would have been during this time frame. So that's kind of a nice touch too, because it's not like we're getting a lot of these like 80s one hit wonders that we've heard kind of throughout. Not necessarily that Kate Bush is a one hit wonder, but I mean certainly more obscure, right, in sort of to that time.
Yeah.
So this was a lot of fun for that purpose. I like that. Like Heather was like, I wonder if Eddie's just going to be bad at guitar. Like that was kind of that was kind of a moment. She was like, kind of thinking would be interesting if he just goes up there and he's just not very good, or he's playing a song that's like not really what you would expect him to do. But then when it went full Metallica, and then it becomes this like almost music video quality.
Yeah, that's right.
Montage.
Yeah.
It really for me, it put me in a very complicated place, because I'm rocking. I'm loving this. Uh-huh. Dustin's just like his headbanging approval periodically was just pitch perfect. But then you've got like the real, menacing situation with Max and Vecna, and you're like, this isn't great, you know, and there's all this other stuff going on. You know, you've got the jocks are mm-hmm. have made their presence known, and so like there's a lot of danger, and I'm trying to rock out, but then you remember this song, especially then, would have been the kind of song that would have implied danger and
yeah.
it's a risky tune. So it's like, it really kind of went full circle for me. And well, it's fantastic.
Yeah. I thought it was great. It's interesting what they decide to bring into the show, because I think that they really traffic a lot in pop culture stuff. And I would never have considered Metallica pop culture in the 80s. They've become pop culture.
Right, exactly.
And so the kinds of music that they'll bring in, and they will bring in sort of an obscure band from time to time, but they have not brought in metal until now. It's like they knew that they had a real great gem of a pop culture reference that they hadn't, like they had it up their sleeve and they were going to use it, but four seasons in, we have not seen them use it yet. And all of a sudden, they pull it out for this finale episode. And I'm more thrilled with the pop culture reference than I am with the plot development that it is showcasing.
Mm.
And so it's like they've gone to this next level with the cultural references. The cultural references are as important for this show as the plot, the story, the, you know, the tone, all of that business.
Right. And it's interesting too, like, but it still doesn't feel like fan service, because it's not something we necessarily even asked for, you know what I mean? So it's like, you get it, and it certainly whets the appetite that mm-hmm. you didn't even know that you were needing. And then on top, like I said, on top of it, when I was able to, and because I was just saying, I was so moved by, like you said, the music and the placement that it did almost take me out of the stuff, mm-hmm. but they edited it so well that it, like I said, it was a complicated moment for me, because I'm like, yeah, oh no, yeah, no, but yeah. And then so you're like, okay, yeah, this is a show. But then I'm like, this again, when I was able to touch back and go, stop looking at Metallica now, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Metallica, look at Metallica then, this would be a dynamite song for a terrifying sequence like they're showing.
Yeah.
Where you don't know if... Where now my expectation, because of looking at it through the lens of 86, now my expectation has shifted. Because at first it was like, oh, this is rockin'. This is how we see our heroes ascend to greatness, because of this anthemic song. Not in 86. In 86, this song would be more foreboding.
Yeah,
that's right. And especially because it's the Master of Puppets, and Vecna's sort of the master of this whole thing, especially when you've got this imagery of people being levitated as if they're being pulled up by puppet strings.
Well, and then the bats.
So now I'm seeing him as the victor, at least in this sequence.
That's right. And it kind of works thematically with it, because, you know, the bats are menacing these boys. And we find out later that their puppet strings kind of get cut.
The idea of everything being connected is real key. Yeah, and I really like, too, the, you know, Steve's little speech to them, like, hey, don't be heroes, right? And
mm-hmm.
and they're like, yeah, we're decoys. And there's something, and there is, that is very much, like, as maybe, you know, somewhat scary or intimidating as like the metal crew could be, a lot of times that my experience with the people that were really into metal in like middle school and high school were sort of marginalized, and like they couldn't be the hero, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, at their absolute best, they were still not going to be the hero, because that's just not
choice. It's like you know, I can think of a few people that I would most associate with this kind of music in junior high and high school. It's like this group of people made a choice to be anti-cultural or countercultural or something.
Anarchists.
I want to talk about another element of this storyline, and that is, it's sort of like one of these things that could go really wrong. And the this is the fact of being a distraction. Have you actually ever been a distraction in your life?
You mean like assigned the distraction role, or just being the guy that is like, well, it's
almost.
I've been a distraction. Don't get me.
I feel like I've seen this in 300 movies. This is not something that happens in real life. So I'm just curious. Have you ever, you know, you've got up to no good in your life? Have you ever been assigned?
I've certainly been a lookout.
Okay, lookout. Yeah. This is something that this is real. You know, you could be a real lookout in real life. Is there anyone that's actually a real distraction?
Like, you know what? I'd have to really ponder. I can't imagine I've gone through life and have not at least assigned somebody to the role of like, you go talk to that. Like at the playground, are you kidding me? With like the teachers, you go talk to the teacher.
We used to do this with yard duties, right?
Yeah. With yard duties, man. You got, you know. And who knows for what? Oh, because we had to go get the kickball because it went over the fence.
Right. So you're going to go talk to the
yard duty. You're not allowed to climb the fence. But if you can keep the yard duty occupied the other direction, then you can make a quick jump over the fence to get the kickball. Which is funny because you can't, it's not like you're like, oh, I want the school to have all their resources back. This is about, oh, I have an opportunity to break a rule.
Yeah. The only time that I can ever think of this actually happening in my life is that our mutual friend Jeff would on purpose get a detention at school. And then because his mother worked at the Apple Ranch, he would bring the detention to her, take her in the back to show her the detention because he knew he was going to get a talking to. And then it was my job to like load up my pockets with candy.
Yeah, see, look at that. I mean, that's
sort of an example of a real life, real world distraction. It wasn't me. I don't think I've ever been a distraction.
And the plan. I mean, the planning. the I'm willing to get a detention because I need Jolly Ranchers. I mean, that was the connection.
Yeah, this is one of those times where it's like, all right, every movie is going to have someone that, you know, going to have a plan that's going to have need a distraction. But this is not something that happens in real life. And I was racking my brain to think, does this ever happen to me? Have I ever been a distraction?
Well, this distraction, I mean, the stakes are pretty high.
This is a pretty important distraction. And I kind of feel like if you're going to do a distraction, you have to make it as thrilling as everything else that's going on in the plot. Because otherwise it's going to feel really cliche.
Right.
And I thought, yeah, this is the perfect distraction. It's thrilling. You know, it's important. Of course, it's important. But you want it to be thrilling. You want it to be just as interesting as what's going on in the attic.
Yeah, and that's exactly it, right? Because could you have done this without that? Perhaps. And you do have a lot of characters to maintain. But there's also, I mean, it's if you're going to write this up, this is a great way to do it. Because it does, you know, what they've done really well is split people up and sort of mix and match and show. And this is just a real testament to how they've developed these characters. I mean, to see Dustin and Eddie together is not a stretch. But this is still like, this is an OG character with a strictly season 4 character. And
who I was pretty sure at the very beginning of episode 1, this guy's gonna die,
right? And I think it is interesting too, the, you know, and obviously we'll talk about this in part 2 of this, so I won't get too into it, but yeah, the idea that how do you, because I don't feel like it would have been shocking to like to have a character you introduce die in this season. Let's be honest. Eddie's survival is complicates anything you're doing next.
That's true because of the I was going to say the Phantom Menace, the Satanic Panic.
Yeah.
The Satanic Panic. You're going to have to resolve that in a way that feels realistic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so far, and we got zero Powell and Callahan in this episode.
Right.
So,
which I find interesting.
Yeah. So the fact that Eddie dies does kind of resolve the issue. They're going to have to.
It puts the focus back on the Upside Down.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to roll it.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Max and the Sinclair kids. Max, Lucas, and Erica go to the right side up murder house. Erica sets up shop across the street in the playground. Meanwhile, Jason hears that there are strange things happening at the murder house. Lucas and Max wait in the Creole living room and write each other notes. They agree to a movie date. Then Max powers down her Kate Bush force fields and makes contact with Vecna. This triggers a Vecna vision. Max attempts to hide in her memoryscape, specifically in her snowball memory. Then Jason and his basketball goons arrive and chase down Erica. There was something about the chase down of Erica that made me think of Karate Kid.
Mm. There were, I think, for me, a lot of Karate Kid moments throughout the season. That for sure is
there's a lot of, I think that they could have done more with this. You know, you've got the karate in Russia, you know, with Murray. You've mm-hmm. got the, you know, the East Coast kid moves out west,
right?
Although it's sort of a Midwest kid moves out west, and then
which has Lost Boy vibes.
Yeah, in addition to that, sure. And then there was something about Erica. She was running away from the kid bad guys at night.
Yeah, and they're all the other guys are look the same.
You know, yeah, that's right. Same. That's right. And so there was a little part of that that kind of made me think, like, even though they didn't do a sort of a smoking gun homage to Karate Kid, that's kind of what got to me with that scene.
That's, man, it was such an important part of this finale. Is, like we've talked about, is that, like, the some of the terror and some of the real menace. I mean, like, obviously Vecna's out here, you know, we'll learn that he's gonna just basically upend civilization, which is a big deal.
Sure.
But yeah. There's also these very real, almost righteously motivated, you know, villains that are coming out, which is another thing that's kind of an interesting parallel, right? I mean, they think they're doing what they think is best according to their ideology.
Oh yeah, right? Well, you know,
and when, you know, it's, some of it's based on some revenge, but yeah. Some of it's also just, you know, so there's all the parallels are pretty fascinating, right? And the power, like Vecna's power, is certainly unique, but the power to destroy, the power to kill, is, you know, that's kind of shown in this, is that it's up for grabs, you know, that kind of power.
I felt like when Jason walks up those stairs, I mean, I think that they just framed this perfectly. You know, that, you know, here we have the quote unquote bad guy character, but you could totally understand from a guy with his worldview, this is absolutely what he was expecting to find.
Mm-hmm.
Right. This is the, you know, is this what you did to Chrissy? You know, and, you know,
right.
Everything that he's saying, like, you know, so did you summon this Vecna with your cult? Everything that he thinks sounds just as plausible as everything that Lucas is trying to explain. Right.
Right.
You know,
right, exactly.
Lucas just sounds like, what do you, this is, you know, to each character, the other one sounds insane.
Mm hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah, and it's it is wild, right? And so he's trying to explain, it's like, he's like, which is an interesting tack on you know, Lucas's part, because I think there's a part where he's like, well, you already believe that there's something supernatural going on. So let me explain exactly what it is. Like, you're right, but you're wrong about how.
Uh-huh.
And then, but then it's like, that's not what I signed up for.
This is a classic.
I signed up for good guys versus bad guys, yeah, right. Devil versus angels, period. Mm-hmm.
This is a classic faith versus science conversation.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Right. Well, and I think that is the other thing that's interesting, too, is that the idea of belief. You know what I mean? It's right. Like, I believe this. Yeah, right? Yeah. So I believe that you and your cult have the ability to raise people out of the water and break their bones. And they're like, yeah, well, you've seen it. This is actually what it is. There's a demon monster from another dimension that can be summoned this way, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, no, that's not what I asked. that's not what it was. I just believe in the spooky other world, and that's it. And then the other part of that is that, like, well, here's how we would fight it. Like, no, Jesus fights. Like, that's kind of...
It's either going to be Jesus or this gun. And
well, there may be another commentary you want to take with that, mm-hmm. too.
That's right. One of the things that we noted at the very beginning of this season was just the emotional payload that was resting on Max's shoulders. And I thought that this paid that off really well. I really thought that she conveyed a sense of feeling suicidal right after the scene where you believe that she wants to get back together with Lucas. So you got these two really important Max scenes juxtaposed. She's really having this important, tender connection with Lucas. And then to hear her talk about the loss of Billy in the attic, I really got the sense that she does. There's a little part of her that feels suicidal, and she's probably using that to lure Vecna. But I don't feel like she's totally faking it. What do you think about that?
Oh, I don't think she was faking it at all. I think that's where we land, right? Where we talked about the narrative armor, and so we thought maybe she's her you know, peril has kind of come and gone, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of what we figured. You can't go twice. We went through so much emotions to watch her, you know, conquer it.
They did the Butch and Sundance thing where, like, if they rob the train in both directions, they're not going to be expecting it the second time back.
Right.
Because no one's ever robbed a train in both directions. And that's what the Duffer brothers did with Max.
Yeah. But then at this point, you start to realize, oh, this, her story's not done, right? Like, mm-hmm. So this relationship with Billy, this torment or whatever. And I think there may be a part of when you look back, when she puts herself as bait, she's like, hey, you know, you could put another kid in the situation. They don't know what they're up against. And I think that that's partly her strategy. I think the other part of her strategy is, I think I got some other stuff I got to deal with. I mean, to some degree, Vecna held up a mirror that she was maybe, I mean, obviously not ready to look at, but at the same time, for whatever reason, felt like, well, maybe I do need to look at this. Maybe I do have some culpability, or maybe maybe it's okay.
Yeah.
If I'm the bait and things go awry, if for the greater good, I can, you know, if I can take what I'm going through emotionally and internally, and then somehow turn that into the greater good,
part of her that's, you know, playing with suicidal ideation. You know, she wrote notes to everyone. I think that there's a little part of her that thinks, if someone has to be bait, it probably should be me, because I deserve it. I probably deserve to die.
And I've already kind of, at one point, been, like, preparing to die.
That's right.
Right. You know, so this is, it's, you know, and so it's like, hey, put it all out there, right? I mean, odds are if I go again, and I think she's, you know, she's like, she's seen some stuff with this guy. So it's like, if I go into this, it's probably a long shot that I'm going to come out of it. So I'm going to go in clean, so to speak. And So I think that it was real. I think that she really did feel that way. She may have put herself, I would say pour it on thick, but she may have leaned into some things that maybe she was wrestling with.
Sure.
But then just kind of went all in with it. Like, hey, well, if I felt like maybe there's a part of me that didn't want him around, so therefore I might as well have been okay with him dying.
I really like the, I like it whenever they put Vecna's voice in another character's mouth.
Oh, yeah.
Vecna takes the shape of Lucas in this case. I just think that that's so much more menacing than the actual Vecna monster. And it could be because I've never really sold on the special effects of this thing. Or maybe it just gives some of my favorite actors something new to do.
Yeah.
But I love the Billy. I love it when he takes the shape of Billy. I love the way that, you know, I just love all of that stuff.
Yeah. And I think, you know, going back to what you're talking about with the Vecna thing, I don't think that I have an issue with the effects of it. It's just that he's so not of this world at this point. Like if it, like when he's won, he's so much more menacing.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's, like, you understand who he is and what he is, and there's something about coming face to face with a human terror.
I think you're right. I think that the actor that plays one in human form is so much more creepy.
Right.
Than the actual monster.
You can do a lot more with his face, and like I said, there's something about becoming like, oh, there's a monster, and it's like when you see a human quote monster, it also sort of leaves you in a state where, like, how could I do this? You know, so there's another element of that.
Interesting.
If you have a spider monster, you're like, yeah, that makes sense.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the other thing about this is that when he's in the shape of one or Henry or whatever, I kind of feel like this is a serial killer narrative.
Right.
And when he's in the shape of the upside down monster, Vecna, I feel like, oh, that's what this guy should do. I mean, he's if he wants.
What are the odds of this guy's nice?
what are the odds of this guy is not gonna bring about Armageddon? That's just what that's what he was born to do.
Right. Yeah. Put some pants on, and we'll talk. Man, I was in for how they're writing everything to each other, like,
oh,
both, you know,
perfect. Perfectly.
Yeah, the way that everybody wrote to each other. It was just great. And I, watching it the second time, I guess I didn't really pick up on as much on it. You know, I think it may have been also like having watched Papa and then watching this like back to back. That's a lot, like to your point, right? Because like, I mean, that is essentially like binge watching like five or six episodes.
Yeah, that's
so by
right.
So by the time I get to this one, it was really easy for me to conflate the two episodes, and so I think I got into this one, and it was nice to just sit down and rewatch this one on its own to try to take in some of those richer details. I think that really were, and that to me that was something that really put me in a different
mindset.
You're talking
about the Lucas and Max writing notes to each other, right?
Yeah, like that really was great. His character's been so great this season, and I think he's always been good, but it always kind of felt like he was of the, like, well, Willow's always of the four. He's the guy from Hangover that they're looking for, but
yeah, right, sure.
But you know, Lucas kind of moved some of the emotional complications along, but I never really felt like he had anything on to own himself, and this season was. Really, it was such a treat to really have him be such a centerpiece, especially his journey going from the wanting the popularity, verbalizing it. Like, it's such a relatable introduction to him, and I kind of thought that maybe he was going to be kind of the similar character that he had been throughout the seasons, where it's like, okay, so he's going to be the complication, you know, of there, and then eventually he'll come around, and it'll be a moment where it's like, hey, it's good to be an outcast or a nerd again, and it's like, well, yeah, but that was not how we got there, and we got there through his journey specifically, and I think that was really...
Well, his character changes
just a
lot.
Unexpected treat.
I just think his character changes a lot if you remove Mike from the equation. I mean, if you think back to the previous seasons, Mike and Lucas have something of a rocky relationship. You know, Mike is always sort of doing things that are motivated by love or impulse or something. And Lucas is usually like the voice of reason. And then they butt heads at times. And so if you remove Mike entirely from Hawkins, I think it allows Lucas to bring out
which is all you ever want. You want Mike. You want Mike removed.
I want Mike gone. I shouldn't say. I was talking to my son about this afterwards. I was thinking, you know, actually, he's pretty great in season one, and I probably should revisit seasons two and three. I think that sometimes he's just. I don't think he appreciates Karen enough. And I think that this kind of soured him.
That's why she did her hair that way.
That's right. Okay, I'm going to roll this thing. All right, we have ourselves a five. Jonathan tries and fails to book a flight to Indiana. Eleven gets the idea to help Max remotely from Nevada. All she needs is a tank, some water, and salt. Argyle saves the day with his pizza pie prowess. They bribe their way into a Nevada pizza place and turn the fridge into a tub. Max makes Eleven a pair of goggles, and Argyle makes Mike eat Hawaiian pizza. Jonathan and Will share a moment of brotherly connection. Then Eleven projects into the astral plane to check on Max. She steps into Max's memory scape and searches for her. This kind of starts with Eleven staring at a billboard. Do you remember this scene?
Yeah.
Because I watched this a couple times, and I'm
trying to find the significance of the billboard.
Yeah, what the heck is up with the, like, what is it about the billboard that gives her the idea for a piggyback?
Right, yeah, because it jogs a memory of her mother, and then Billy, and all of that stuff, right? And yeah. I'm trying to figure out, is the girl getting a piggyback ride?
I wonder. Maybe I'm looking at the wrong part of the billboard.
I think maybe we're looking at the, now that I, because I am making the connection that maybe she was getting a piggyback ride, and that was just much more on the nose than we realized. Yeah, we're trying to find out what's the symbolism going on.
For like the religious significance of the.
We're trying to do a very close reading of this billboard. Yeah, she's for sure getting a piggyback ride. That's just it. So she sees a girl getting a piggyback ride and thinks, oh, I bet you I can piggyback. And we're going, well, like, okay, so it's a scenic route. Okay, there's AAA. There's three A's. What are the three A's that we're looking for here? Okay, Eddie's an anarchist, perhaps. Maybe that's one of the A's.
Okay. I'm looking at this. And then
the guy's kind of faded. So I'm like, oh, is it like a Back to the Future thing? Is the guy getting faded because he hasn't completed his mission yet? He hasn't gotten his mom and dad together yet?
Okay, so this has this scene with Jonathan and Will.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is meant to be the emotional payoff to it.
Right.
And I do feel like, I don't know if I'm supposed to read this as Jonathan knows Will is gay, or if he just saw him crying and he knows he's like, dealing with trauma, or he's just going through some emotional stuff. It's never said. There's nothing ever said in this episode about this fact. How are you reading this conversation?
I read it as he does know that Will is gay, and I think it's because I'm giving the benefit of the doubt to their relationship, their family relationship, right? The idea that, you know, we only see Jonathan and Will through the lens of Stranger Things episodes and whenever they're together, blah, blah, blah. And the idea that Jonathan is a very sensitive sort. He has been a surrogate, you know, father for this young boy all the way through.
Right, right.
If anyone would be picking up on the clues at some point, I would think that would be it.
Well, also, even back to season one, you know, he has that really touching conversation. He's like, don't be normal. Being normal is boring.
Right.
You know, be different. You know, be the kind of person that likes music that other people don't like. And so it's almost permission for him to.
He could have even been planting that seed because he knew maybe better than Will did at that point. Right. I mean, that's possible.
That's also possible. I just kind of felt like it's unclear to the. It's unclear to the viewer what Jonathan is actually saying here. I feel like because it's fairly clear to me that Will is gay, that this is what Jonathan is talking about.
Yeah, and I think it's meant, and I think so there are a couple things you can read into why it's not explicit, right? One, you know, maybe we don't get really explicitly into it while we're trying to save the world at this particular moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing being, even if you know, and even if you're supportive, in 1986, that's a conversation that people don't have a lot of training on.
You talk around it.
It's not part of Indiana culture, that's uh-huh. for sure. And it was barely a part of California culture. You know, I mean, in 86, we were not great at acceptance, right? I mean,
and I think maybe
he doesn't, I don't even think he's got the vocabulary. I don't think he's got
I think a lot of viewers who didn't grow up in California might think, well, yeah, of course, it's just a liberal California. People just accept gay people. It's just not how it was. It's unless you were like, there are very few places in the country where you can be openly gay and it'd be okay. And I don't think that there's anywhere in the country where you can be a kid and gay and it'd be okay.
I think we're meant to believe that he knows because the big conversation in the back of the van, he knows too that Elle didn't commission this painting. You know what I mean? It's like, there's a lot of there, like he I think makes all the connections at that point and sees what's really going on. Mm-hmm. And I think because of the circumstance, because of not necessarily having the vocabulary and the, you know, just basically don't have as much capability to have that conversation in 1986. You can tap dance around it and say, look, I know, you know what I'm talking about and we're cool, you know? And I think that's very brotherly too, keeping in mind that Jonathan's, while he looks 50, he's not in this scene. He's also a young boy, quote unquote.
Have you ever dealt with the Lego up the nose situation?
Something similar. We had a, I was maybe 6, 7, something like that. And we had I had color forms, like the same way I would have Hot Wheels and Legos. Like, they were just a mashup of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in it was this little metal round, looked like a gear that we have gone to like a stomper or something.
Sure.
And I just shoved that thing right on my nose. I don't know I don't know why. I don't know. And I wasn't like.
Now, did you have to go to the doctor for this?
It was a bit of panic. And it was pretty far. And I don't remember how. I think they just kept on forcing me to just try to honk it out. And uh-huh. eventually it did. But man, I was like, this is who I am now. I'm part machine. Half man, half stomper.
Okay, I'm going to roll this thing.
Is that all we want to talk about all that? I mean, we're not going to talk about pineapple on pizza. We're not going to talk about Argyle's amazing. Yeah, got to be clean if you're going to enter the mind. I mean, that's amazing. I love how Argyle is. And did we talk about this already? I don't know. Like, we have the first season. Yeah, we talk about how you've got the kids that are equipped to get right into fighting monsters because they live in their imagination and uh-huh. adults uh-huh. have outgrown it. And so now you've got everybody that's older, and how do you introduce somebody who's got that same level of lives in their imagination, lives in a fantasy world? Well, you get a stoner from, you know, Southern California who's just like, yeah, uh-huh. dude, why not? Why wouldn't it be?
It's an interesting parallel with Murray, with Argyle, because Murray is prepared for this because his whole... the life of his imagination is wrapped up in conspiracy theories, right?
Right.
So that's a different kind of fantasy scape he's created for himself. And so some of this weirdness kind of fits in with that. Argyle isn't into conspiracy theories, although I think he does promote a few conspiracy theories about the amount of skate schmacking that's going on throughout the world. Right. I do think that he's just, like he says, he's very spiritual. And
down for whatever.
I think that I kind of don't like the word spiritual because it could mean like a ton of different things.
Right.
But he's the kind of guy that's looking for mushrooms at the end of this.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so his...
The idea of being able to exist on another plane is completely in his wheelhouse.
Oh, yeah. He's fine
so
with it.
So if you're going to tell me that there's other dimensions where you can travel with your mind and then some of those might not be good, he's like, dude, I've been there, bro.
This guy... It's actually kind of a sophisticated little window into religious studies. When he says you got to be clean to enter the mind, this is sort of a window into, I mean, four or five different really important religions. There is absolutely a connection between baptism and spiritual purity.
Right.
So and for him to say that.
There's so many bathing rituals.
Uh-huh. That's right. So for him to say that, it totally makes sense in his framework. Now, of course, you know, again, we're going to have a faith versus science conversation because Mike is incredulous.
Right, right.
He's like, how could you not know this?
But that's what I love about it, right? Because it is, everything is blurring the line. And everyone, you know, everyone has their own way of trying to rationalize, right? Yeah. So you have Jason who rationalizes this like, well, it must be evil. It must be satanic. And we as good Christians have to stop it by any, like, instead of then going to the other direction that says, well, then we need to be, in order to stop this spiritual warfare, we need to engage on the other side of the spirituality. Takes matters into his own hands. You've got this other guy who's, you know, foraging for mushrooms, who's, you know, he's just all about whatever, you know. You know, try before you deny. You know, that's just sort of a beautiful mantra.
That's really his life ethic, really. Try
and, before and, you and deny. So here he is, and they're like, "Hey, we're gonna have to go travel into somebody's mind." And he's like, "Yeah, yeah, for sure. Let's get some salt. You know, whatever it takes." And I think that there's something kind of fascinating about that, right? So here, and this is maybe me taking another leap, but like, Jason is. And maybe this is a conscious critique by the Duffers, but Jason is a product of hand-me-down theology and ideology. This is what I was raised with. This is what I was raised with. I only have as much information as I've been given and have much information I choose to engage with. Give me the blanket. Give me the bullet points. I'm going to come on Sunday, and I'm gonna get what I need, and then I'm going to go out, and everything else is up to me.
So then he's just going to plug what he learns into this paradigm, this precept.
Argyle is experiential. Argyle has opened his mind by virtue of whether it's been marijuana, whether it's been mushrooms, whatever. He's experienced. So everything, whenever if someone says to him, hey, I'm dealing with this monster from another world, he's like, I too have had a bad trip. And so his experience makes him much more open and actually much more willing and helpful in many ways. Because he's like, oh, you're going on a journey too. I mean, so you know, whether all of that is conscious, it certainly resonates.
Well, there are two different sides of the religious coin. And in religious studies, we would say something like, it's the difference between the priest and the prophet. So the priest is sort of there to protect the tradition.
Right.
And the prophet is there to upset the tradition. And so you kind of need both sorts of voices. And, in this case, it just turns out that the prophet is closer to being helpful. They're both wrong, you know. In this case,
sure,
they're both wrong, but they're wrong for different reasons.
I will say, as somebody who has both gone to a Christian summer camp and done mushrooms, there's only one of those I would try again.
All right, I'm rolling. Oh wait, Hawaiian pizza.
What's your relationship with Hawaiian?
Okay, so during this, you know, we're watching the scene, and my son's like, "Oh, this is so cringy. They're bringing in the whole Hawaiian pizza debate." Now, I'm not on social media, and I haven't been on social media for years now. So there is a lot about pop culture that I just have divorced myself from. I do happen to know that there's a debate about fruit on pizza.
Right, which makes a lot of sense because this has been going on for, what, decades now?
this predates the internet.
Yeah, a little bit.
All right, and then I couldn't help but think of your recommendation to me that you can do pineapple on pizza, but you have to add jalapenos.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately I thought, I should try this. This is something I gotta try. But my son's reading of this was that they were sort of winking to these online debates, and he found it cringy.
Mm.
So.
Well, yeah. I mean, this will make sense to your son later. Is that not everything is about his generation?
This is something that probably won't make sense to him, because here we are talking in this podcast making everything about our generation.
Well, partly because in this
we never learned this lesson, Steve.
No. I think it might be looking at it as a wink and a nod to, hey, you know, this will, like, maybe like it's relating to or trying to relate to, mm-hmm. like it's like a like an old guy trying to be hip. I would go it's a step further. It says this is not, there's nothing new under the sun.
Sure.
Pineapple on pizza was controversial back then. It's controversial now. It's just now people have ways to talk about it incessantly with people all over the world. Whereas before it was just something that would be a conversation that would happen at a straw hat.
do you enjoy pineapple on pizza?
Yeah. Hawaiian pizzas probably would be my go-to if I was getting a personal pizza.
Wow. Okay. Now, that's interesting to me, because while I don't mind it and I don't have a strong opinion about it, it'd probably be like, probably wouldn't even be on my top 10 of the kinds of pizzas that I'd order it. But if it was sort of like I'm hanging out with friends and there's pizza out there, and I saw it in front of me, I thought, ooh, I might think, this is a treat. I haven't had this in a while.
Yeah. Well, and that's how I see it most of the time, because nobody in my family likes it. Uh-huh. So I can't really order it. But if I was going to, like you and I talked about offline, if you're going to give me, like, hey, go order a pizza for yourself, pepperoni, jalapeno, pineapple.
It just seems like I don't know. Maybe I should try before I deny.
I was just going to say.
All right, I'm rolling this thing.
And by the way, have you called the phone number on the Surfer Boy pizza?
I saw that this was a thing. I have not tried it. What did
you? It's precious. It's precious.
Oh, are you recommending to our fans to try it?
Go for it. Give it a shot.
Are you going to explain to us what happens, or you just want to leave it?
No, just call. Find out.
Okay. All right. We already have 3. We already have a 5. Oh, this is a moon.
Bank the moon in case of a goocher?
This is a 6. You could bank this thing, or I feel like for our fans, they're going to want to hear this one.
All right.
I think for our listeners, they are absolutely going to want to hear you answer this.
Assuming they haven't turned it off because we're morons about a billboard.
Okay, this is 6. This is a moon, Steve. Tell us about the night you partied with Metallica.
Oh, well, it wasn't all of Metallica.
All right, so start at the beginning. We want to hear the story.
We won't be talking about the time that I hung out ever so briefly with Lars Ulrich, the drummer, because he came to see Todd Barry, and I was opening for Todd Barry, so I got a picture with him. That's not, because we didn't party. Jason Newsted.
So you met Lars, but you didn't hang out with him.
Right. So I was a regular on a local radio station for a needle droppings segment. So it was new records that were coming out, and like the guy that owns the record store would play snippets, and there would be a panel that would kind of give their first impressions, and you know, it was kind of, you know, a little bit of comic relief, a little bit of musical knowledge, I like to think. And and they said, hey, we have a guest in studio, and it was Jason Newsted, who was formerly of Metallica. So he played on a lot of the earlier albums. I think Injustice for All was his last, I think.
Okay.
But anyway, so he was there, and I was bringing in wine. I was working at a winery at the time, so I'd always bring in wine for the group. And the DJ was always particularly fond of white wine, so I brought in a Viognier. Sitting in on the segment with Jason Newsted, you know, talking a little bit, cracked a few jokes, and then we hung out for the needle drop and saying we had and like and him and his new band, they were there and he was just going on. He's like, oh, I gotta see you play. And I brought out the wine and he's like, oh, Viognier is my favorite. Not exactly what I thought. I
had to... this is not on brand,
right? For a so I told him I told him, you know, on air, I'm like, you know, this is really exciting for me. I'm a big fan. But I will say that I'm a little cautious because you were always the scariest face on the Metallica, cassette liners. Sure. Of all the guys, I'm like, everybody was intimidating. You know, Lars looked a little crazy. Mm-hmm. Kirk looked like, you know, he was a tough guy. You know, James, of course, is the wild front man. But you were the one that I'm like, you're the one I would be the most afraid to be around. And I'm like, I just feel like at any moment you're just gonna lunge at me, and I'm just nervous. And so we did laugh. Ah, I'm not that kind of guy. So then after the whole show thing gets done, we go over to a restaurant across the street that the DJ and producer know we're well. So we're having some more wine. We're having some appetizers, and everyone's feeling it a little bit. And they start telling different stories about, you know, like, you know, experiences at concerts and this and that. And mm-hmm. At one point, Newstead just starts going off about this one incident and like some issues that were with security. And so like he's like, oh, you know, and he grabs me like this. And then he grabs me to demonstrate how security grabbed him. And I'm like, it's no, happening.
This is very on brand.
I'm like yelling, this is what I was afraid of. I just didn't realize it was going to be fueled by Viognier. Anyway, we had a great time, and
and it's kind of awesome that he assaulted you because
yeah,
it's sort of like a childhood fascination. I wouldn't say it's a childhood dream. You didn't really want to be assaulted, but you were right. Afraid of it, and it happened.
Right. It's like if I went to the zoo and they're like, hey, you know, really something when you see like the gorillas attack each other, you know, uh-huh. Play, you know, and then you go there and like, oh, yeah, one of them's sick and the other one's asleep. And you're like, oh, man. I mean, yeah, they're there. It's cool. I guess I could pull up a video. Like I went one time, took my daughter and her classmates to the zoo. I was like the chaperone. And there was like, you know, those various monkeys and they're always going to do something with each other's butts. Like, at least you see it on YouTube all the time. Mm-hmm. And so there's kind of this, like, I hope there's something. And then, you know, we're just watching these monkeys, and they're just up there, and they're just sort of just looking at us. And then finally one comes over and just starts eating the other one's ass. And I was like, yes, finally. Like, this is what you come here for, right? So that was my James, mm-hmm. Or Jason Newsted.
Bringing a new meaning to the concept of a moon. With a little bit of a Gucci thrown in there, I think. Okay, I'm rolling this thing.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood and the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, so this is another moon. Jeez, I feel like maybe we should bank one of these.
I think we should bank the moon, and then we can bank it.
Okay, because I could incorporate the moon into our following episode here. Shoot, that's interesting stuff. All right, I'm going to roll this.
Now we roll again.
Yeah,
with the moon banked.
The moon is banked. Okay, this is number one. This is the Russia plot. Yuri fiddles with Katinka. Joyce puts on a Hulkamania t-shirt and then admires Hopper's new abs. Hopper is all horned up about breadsticks. This leads to a long-awaited Russian Orthodox kiss. Hopper gets a phone call from Lady Goo number one. He learns that all the kids are on their way to Hawkins to fight evil. Joyce suggests that they break back into the prison to destroy the Mind Flayer skin tag. Hopper unpacks a flamethrower and they all drive back to the prison. Then Jack and Hagar appeals to Yuri's patriotism to get him to fix the chopper. Once inside the prison, Yuri learns that the thing they call the Shadow has escaped to possess multiple bodies. But the Russian telling the story dies before they can find out who has been possessed. So I think that the story that they're telling here is that the smoke baby goes into the Demogorgon. So if they kill the Demogorgons, they'll kill the smoke monster, or the demidogs, they'll kill the smoke monster.
Well, I think the idea too is the demidogs that were in the test tubes or whatever, were they like supposed to be dead? And then that gave them life.
And that maybe that's what animated them. That's interesting.
Because I was trying to figure out initially, like, I'm like, so why did it go in there? Aren't they already that thing? You know, like, what was it about that connection? But
sure.
Then it was like, oh, well, maybe because they were all in those tubes. How would they have gotten out of the tubes? And, like, if they were in the tubes, I would have thought that they had been studied. Because I had already had one open. So my assumption was that these were not being kept alive. These were being examined.
Okay, so here's my issue with this. I think the first time I watched this, I assumed that the smoke monster went into the guards.
Right. Right.
And then
that's what I thought.
We were going to eventually see guards with, like, you know, zombified guards or whatever.
Right. Just sort of like what we saw in season 3.
And then the second time I watched it, no, I'm pretty sure he means that that's what animated the demodogs, but when he kills them, it's not like the there's like smoke that leaves their body or something.
Right.
And I'm kind of not buying that you can kill this smoke monster by killing the body that it inhabits. I'm still wondering, maybe we see this followed up in season 5.
Yeah, I feel like that was something, like it was a dramatic build up for something that I was like, well, what was the point? So I feel like maybe that is yet to come. That's my assumption, is that it's yet to come, right? And like, mm-hmm. and there could be an element of, well, is this Will's problem? Is this thing always going to live as long as Will's alive?
Oh, interesting. Because there's some kind of connection. Because
because it's in him, right? I mean, like, because it's never left him. So yeah. I wonder.
It does make me wonder, like, all right, if they want to bring the Russia stuff back into season 5, how do you do it? I mean, it's possible that you'll have Yuri and the Antonov character in Hawkins.
There has to be something.
Like they relocate or something. But another way to do that is to bring in like a Russian army that is sort of possessed by the Upside Down.
Right. The thing that gets me a little bit too is that because of, you know, I think we've been clear that like the Russia plot has been sort of our least favorite, the one we've engaged with the least. And then as we were moving along, like, oh, there's more to it. There has to be some sort of connection. Maybe there's a gate here.
Yeah.
That's how they travel. And those things didn't quite come to fruition. So then when it comes down to it, I'm like, so if you're going to tell me after all of that, you created this kind of arduous narrative just to then say, well, they'll, you know, if they kill these, then it sort of takes a little bit. It sort of wounds Vecna from afar. Mm-hmm. It's like, was that really you could have just not. You know, you could have done something different. So it feels to me like that. This is the benefit of the doubt that I may be giving, because it's always seemed to have paid off with the showrunners, is I feel like there's still like that story hasn't fully come to fruition yet. And if it has, then I'm like, okay. I mean, you're really just drawing out the Hopper reunion, and then at that point, truly, is what it comes down to. And yeah, he gets, because I mean, we almost like, oh, we painted ourselves into a corner with Russia and demidogs, but then what, right? I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I still feel like there's more to it.
I think that's exactly right. The problem is, and then what? Because if this is all that there was with the Russia plot, if they don't revisit this and make this work for some future season 5 storyline, I kind of feel like this was a real big disappointment in an otherwise real stellar season.
Right, yeah. Because we endured a lot to watch Hopper endure a lot.
We did.
And if it was just to basically like, oh, we wipe out a couple of these and it kind of helps neutralize.
Okay, we did get to see Hopper and Joyce finally get romantic.
Right.
And so that was...
And all Heather could think is, God, he's got a stink. His mouth has got a taste.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's exactly... you know, Joyce is... She's been through a few... You know, she's got sort of travel mouth... She hasn't showered yet. You know, she's not going to, but it's not going to be the same as months in a Russian gulag.
He says he ate maggots. That's got to have an effect on your breath.
He ate maggots. Joyce, he ate maggots. He just talked about eating maggots. You're going to kiss him? I don't know. I don't know what's going on here. Have you ever...
The Hulk Hogan shirts were just an absolute treat.
Hulk Hogan was nice. I liked that. For sure.
The puffy jackets.
That lovely. Was good. So I was going to ask you, is this reunion finale worthy for you?
The Joyce and...
Because I'm trying... I am of the opinion that this did not have to be 2 hours and 20 minutes long. And I kind of feel like you could easily delete 3 hours from this season by deleting the Russia plot. And I kind of feel like that's a lot to build up for this this very brief kiss.
You know, and it's interesting too because, and I'm sure for some fans it's different. You know, maybe you and I were not as like, when are Hopper and Joyce going to finally get together?
Yeah, this is not a Sam and Diane situation.
Yeah, I'm happy they are, but I also was like, I kind of rather enjoyed the tension of his inability to sort of seal the deal, and he would always get in his own way, and like, so there was something about that was, I always found kind of charming, and so I kind of liked it. So when it's like, oh, they're finally together, I guess I never really had that same, like, will they or won't they kind of moment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this was a payoff, I think, for those that would have maybe felt more like that. And for me, those two getting together was certainly way lower on the list than the Steve-Jonathan-Nancy triangle.
I just felt like I'm happy to see them get romantic. It was long overdue. I don't know if I needed an entire 3 hours of television building up to this point.
Yeah, yeah.
Because nothing else about this plot feels climactic at all to me. Anyway, we can put that to bed. I am going to roll this. We have ourselves a Goocher, Steve.
Oh, Jesus, man, that's a Goocher.
And then we didn't bank that moon for nothing.
Okay, all right, so it's a Goocher killer, so I'm going to roll again. This is a 5. I'm going to go ahead and roll this again. We have ourselves a 2. The Scooby-Doo gang flip into the Upside Down. Steve, Nancy, and Robin walk through the woods to the murder house. Steve shares a moment with Nancy and tries to get her back. Once at the house, they wait for Vecna to take the bait. Then they hopscotch over the Vecna vines and head up to the attic. I'm totally in the bag for Steve now. It's kind of amazing because he was a full-on bad guy in season 1. I am so in the bag for Steve and Nancy to hook up. I don't care about Jonathan, and I don't care if he ever finds love ever again.
Just kidding. Now you're just wishing ill on Jonathan.
I want Jonathan to take a vow of celibacy, move to a monastery, and that's him. He can just like transcribe old scriptures or something. So I'm happy to see that Nancy is at least open to the idea of taking Steve back.
It's wild. It is a wild, wild journey that we've gone on.
We have adults in this narrative that are not as mature as Steve Harrington. Steve Harrington has made quite the evolution.
Right. Now, when we look at this, right? Here we are. We've seen this twice. We know how this ends, and I'm sure anybody listening also knows. But I mean, let's go back to where what we were talking about. I mean, I was pretty convinced that Harrington was a goner. So in this, right, at this moment, how much do you feel like, oh yeah, he's a goner? Like when you're watching the early scenes unfold and he's being honest with Nancy, it sure did feel like when he tells don't be a hero, you get to be the hero, Steve. All of those conversations, everything that was going on, I'm like, this is leading. I was gripping and ready.
Yeah.
I was absolutely ready. So at this, since we're doing the first hour, in this hour, I don't know who's surviving. I am full Game of Thrones mode at this point.
Okay. All right. I think I was sort of teetering, and what pushed me over was the fire and rain needle drop from last episode.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking one of these two is probably going to die. And since everyone thinks it's Steve, they're probably right. And now I feel like because all of that has been postponed to season 5, I kind of don't know what to expect.
Well, I'm talking just in this first half, like, because we're looking at this hour. What was your feeling at this point? Did you feel like, as you're watching this unfold, as they're making their way, as they're in their Red Dawn garb, and the way that he's, you know, talking about it was always you, Nancy. He was the hero according to those guys. Does it feel like? Do you feel when you're watching this the first time any closer to like, oh yeah? Did you feel like, yeah, Steve is going, or did you? Or were you kind of in the same, like, on the fence?
I don't remember. I don't remember how I felt. I do think...
Because I was convinced.
You were convinced. It is sort of a common trick that you'll do with a character, especially a male character, to give them a love interest that they feel really close to, and eventually they're going to be satisfied. They're going to, you know, happiness is just right at the tip of their fingers. If they can just get through this next thing, then they'll be able to get the girl. And then that's how they give you sort of an emotional shock when that character dies, or when the woman dies, right? To use as motivation for the male character.
And that's where you're at a perfect spot because he's confessed it, he can go out, and then now Nancy can go back to Jonathan because there's no more of the complication of Steve Harrington, because Steve Harrington's, you know, now it is a full-on love triangle. But it doesn't have to stay that way if Steve Harrington goes out. And so then it becomes, okay, I can go back with Jonathan, but I mean, man, the memory of Steve and what he did, and how can I ever really love Jonathan when that is unreal? You know, so there's that, to me, that was like, yep, it's all lining up. And here we go. So I was just absolutely ready.
Yeah, no, I totally get that. And I think it's justified. And the fact that they were able to pull that off is quite something. So, yeah, kudos again to the Duffer Brothers. They pulled the old switcheroo yet again with Steve Harrington. I really dug the red beret on Robin. did you ever try a beret?
You know, I never purchased a beret.
I always felt like there's a lot of things, and I got, as well attested, I got very, very creative with the hats I would try. But I kind of felt like I knew that a beret was just like,
it's a bridge too far.
It's a bridge. It was like, if there's anything that I know that I can't pull off, it's a beret. yeah, I just felt like you got to be like a French fashion designer to pull off a beret.
I tried a beret once, like not like buying one, but I remember putting one on and I was like, man, it was a hairstyle. Like it was like having a haircut that I knew I couldn't pull off and could tend to. I would only think about how the beret looks at this moment. Like that would be, it would be, I would be the whole time. I was like, is it laying right? Because, you know, it's supposed to, like, when something's supposed to, like, when it works and it's just laying natural and you're like, man, they're pulling that off. And then as you try to recreate it, it's like, oh, I just look like I try to make it look that way.
Now, I did do, like, I don't know what these things are called, but I did do the poofy hat that has the brim. Sort of like, it's like a, it's like a, more of like a tie-dye hat.
Like a Jiffy Pop.
Yeah, that's right. But it kind of hangs down in the back, and it's got that brim up front. I don't even know what you call those things, but it is a little bit beret-like. It just has that that brim, though, that rim.
It's got beret energy, for sure.
It's more of a... Like, it signifies, like, this is the kind of person who would wear a beret if they could solve their body odor problem. Right, that's kind of the feel to it.
Yeah. It's a bohemian beret.
It's a bohemian... The Scooby-Doo gang doesn't get a lot of screen time in this very long episode. But I do want to say one more thing about this, because I think that we've exhausted our storylines. I want to say that one thing that I think sets this season apart from the other seasons is that I feel like you've given all of these characters space to cook. And so whether we're talking about Max, who before was sort of a B-plot character, or you're talking about Murray, or you're talking about, you know, Jonathan or whoever, sometimes some of these characters would kind of fall into a B plot. And I felt like with this season, maybe Mike is the weak link of this season, but everyone else really gets some space to show what they can do. And I really cared about almost all of the storylines. So I don't know. Maybe sort of the Hopper thing was the weak link.
Which is kind of wild because season three ends with, is he dead? And so there's this, the idea that he's alive and needs to come back really should hold more of our attention, I would mm-hmm. think. Mm-hmm. And it really should be a central point. And it's interesting that it wasn't. And it could be that it was no fault of anything that they were doing with what was going on in Russia. It's just that by comparison to all the other things that are happening, if you were to lay it out on paper, you'd be like, wow, you mean this guy's has to break out of a Russian gulag that is also infested with demigorgons, and he's and there's going to be Murray doing karate, and there's going to be a Hulk Hogan shirt involved. Like, if you put that out in front of me, I'd be like, oh yeah, good luck. How am I even going to pay any attention to whatever's going on in Hawkins? Who cares about, oh, another monster? Are you kidding me? So it's kind of wild that's how good everything else was by comparison. Uh-huh. That one couldn't, steal the show.
Okay, I'm going to give you one tweak to improve this season. All right, so bring in a little Cocoons of Horror magic into this podcast. What if you have zero Hopper until like episode 7? And then all of a sudden, you've totally forgotten about Hopper, and all of a sudden you bring in the Russia plot, like right at the end, and you make all of that happen, all that stuff that happens in Russia, you make all that happen in 20 minutes or something like that. I think that I would have been kind of thrilled to get Hopper back. It's like, when are they going to bring Hopper back? And then they bring him in, and then you reduce that whole storyline from like 3 hours to 20 minutes.
Yeah, like I'll even go a step further. You're in, your momentum is going, boom, 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 boom. And then one entire episode is Hopper in Russia. And you're like, well, this is taking me out of everything else. Uh-huh. And now I'm into this. And then at the end, you see how it's going to tie or something. And then it's like, whoa, now we're cooking, right? Maybe. I mean, I still think that this season is fantastic. I love Paul Reiser in it. I think Eddie's fantastic.
Yeah, forget about how good Reiser is. There's so many other. This really has turned into something of an ensemble cast, right?
Right. And I think, and again, I think that the Satanic Panic subplot is just so good. It's such a, it's such a fascinating thing that is based in a real occurrence that, we live through, and it's so as bizarre as it may seem.
And it's perfect for this show to explore. Perfect show for that particular topic.
The sequence, like the entire episode where Max is wrestling with the idea that she's going to, her death is an inevitability, and how they build that whole sequence where she ends up getting rescued is, I've seen it twice, and I don't think I was any less moved even when I knew what was going to happen. So I think there are elements that are in this season that are clearly the best work that they've done. Now, whether or not it's all together the same thing, that I think is negotiable.
Yeah.
But I definitely, I'm not ready. I mean, prisoner of the moment potentially, but I think that they pulled off so many tricks that is different than what they did in the first season. The first season was just altogether great.
Yeah.
But the tricks that they pulled off in this one, and sort of the payoff of everything, it's kind of hard to, you can't look at them in a vacuum. You know what I mean?
Okay. So when we come back next week, we will thoroughly cover the last hour and 20 minutes of this episode. And we'll also do a little bit of discussion about where this leaves us for season 5.